Part 1. The greatest sources of our suffering are the lies we tell ourselves. Elvin Simrad. We live in a world singularly obsessed with logic. Starting in kindergarten, a catechism of rationalism molds us into computational beings. Throughout our education, we are driven to gather ever more information so as to fit into a society that is already severely information overloaded. Save for the odd course in actor's training or Jungian psychology, institutional learning does nothing to sharpen our emotional intelligence. And completely missing from formal education is any legitimate training to advance our intuitive capacity, which is not even acknowledged to exist. Creativity does not come through logic. It comes through intuition. Powerful emotions then cast its raw material into a vessel for unresolved anguish and shape it into artistic form. Insofar as logic enters the process, it arrives last, like the engineering firm tasked with determining the structural integrity of what it has been handed by nature. It is from intuition that three primal forces call us to write: one personal, one social, and one from the realm of myth and mystery. To recognize these forces and harness their energy, we must first understand what they are and why they call us. The personal call to write lures us into a story to wrestle with unfinished business in our own psychology. Here, a private inner voice taunts us with secrets so tightly held that not even the writer knows exactly what they are or why they have come. Yet, we are also drawn to write by a social call, which drafts us into the archetype of artist to spin a single thread of our generation's collective dream. Millions of artists each contribute their thread to the grand tapestry of our generational struggle by depicting our society in all its shame and glory. The mythological call to write beckons us through a mysterious primal drive, carrying us beyond our private selves or even our sense of the collective. It compels us to reach for the unreachable, in order to discover something far greater, nobler, and more meaningful than any identity we might claim. These three primal forces call to us from out of the deep unconscious through the daydreams of stories. Like dreams by night, they carry symbols into the unconscious mind to be encountered and deciphered through the labyrinth of myth. The next three chapters sharpen our attention to the call to write. Chapter 1, The Personal Call. I will never forget the moment when I first realized I had exposed myself to the world through a play. By Call was my second play, produced by a small theater company in Portland, Oregon. A newspaper article about a 16-year-old girl inspired the story. Nestled into Portland's surrounding farm country is a tight-knit Russian Orthodox community of old believers. Their ancestors had left Siberia 100 years before, outrunning religious persecution by the Tsar. Even over the course of a century, the community has never integrated into American culture. They remain apart, speaking and dressing like Russians in the wilds of Siberia a century before. The girl in the article had become pregnant by an outsider and was ostracized. My play takes place in 1973 during the Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR. My main character, Katrina, is pregnant, tossed out of her community, and unable to function in modern-day America. Driven by desperation, she jumps onto a Russian grain freighter in Portland and asks for asylum. Her simple plan becomes horrifyingly complicated when an army of outraged diplomats descends on the ship to demand her return. The Russians refuse, and a media spectacle ensues. Since the old believers do not register their children's birth, the Americans cannot prove her citizenship, neither can the Russians prove her asylum status. The battle for possession of Katrina becomes a symbol of the bitterness between the U.S. and the USSR, and a wrenching emotional struggle about what it means to be a Russian or an American. It never occurred to me that this could be my story. I'm American of largely English ancestry, whose lineage grants me membership in the Daughters of the American Revolution. I was not from a farming family and was well into my 30s before I wrote By Call. Yet as I heard the lines spoken by the actors, I felt the whole world was hearing my story. In the post-production audience discussion, I fought a torrent of tears, trying to conceal the truth of my shameful past. By Call is a play about someone dislocated from an old-world community who is disoriented in the contemporary world. That is very much my story. I was part of the first generation of a Kentucky clan to be born outside of Appalachia. Although I lived in a city on the West Coast, the world inside my home was pure Kentucky in its faith, language, food, customs, and dynamics. Just as my Russian protagonist was kept from mingling with outsiders, I too was discouraged from making friends of non-relatives in the tradition of my clan back east. My protagonist became pregnant, then exiled at 16, the same age I was when my mother's mother led me into marriage to a man in his 20s. Katrina could not read or write English. Neither could I read the marriage license that my mother signed, granting permission for the matrimony. In the sickening moment she scribbled me away, I desperately wanted someone with diplomatic authority to descend upon the small party at the county clerk's desk inside the courthouse and object to the sale of me. No one came, and no one ever would. As I wrote that play, the personal call to write taunted me with symbols masking real struggles. It was a deeply private attempt to resolve the agony of that ceremony buried long ago. Recognizing the psychological block triggering By Call was challenging, since that experience was too painful to confront in the naked light of conscious reality. That, of course, is why stories come to us in dreamlike images, waiting patiently for the truth behind them to be discovered. Not long after By Call was produced, I recognized a similar personal call in the work of one of my students. Tevin, a pseudonym, set out to draft a screenplay about an unsympathetic man who abandons his wife and baby for the life among his street gang. Tevin had once been a teenage gang member himself, but left that life for higher moral ground after the birth of his own son. Tevin's screenplay, Bloodlines, also a pseudonym, seemingly wrote itself for about 25 pages before dragging and ultimately collapsing by page 40. A typical progression for screenwriters. Tevin was surprised when I asked him if his own father had abandoned him for a gang. Indeed, his father had. It grieved Tevin to learn that instead of adding vitality to his story, the villain he modeled after his father weighed the story down until it ground to a standstill in a puddle of lifeless melodrama. I challenged Tevin to see the villain as himself. "I would never abandon my son," he screamed. "Then you can't write this story," I replied. In defiance of my prediction, Tevin returned to his script. After several weeks of struggle, he stopped coming to class. But the story would not give up on him. It stalked him day and night. Tevin languished in the paralysis of writer's block, growing ever more desperate to tell the tale that would not reveal itself. Finally, he came back to class and sheepishly asked what to do. The answer was simple. He had to identify with his father. "I can't," he said. "What if your old gang's rival suddenly decided to menace you?" I asked. "What if your own son was in danger because of your presence in the home?" "I'd leave," he said, "but only to protect my son." "You are a step closer." "No closer," he insisted. "My father did not leave to protect me. He left because all he cared about was himself." "But you can conceive of the feeling," I said. Tevin did not appreciate my insight, nor did he appreciate his assignment for the next week to contemplate what would make him leave his son. On the following Saturday, in the space of a few seconds, Tevin's writer's block abruptly vanished when he was confronted with a devastating truth about himself. He was working in his front garden with his 2-year-old son at his side when a car backfired. Mistaking the blast for a gunshot, Tevin dove under the porch. When he came to his senses, he saw his son standing alone in the yard, staring at him in confusion. "He wasn't old enough to understand," Tevin said. "But I did. I left him alone in the worst possible circumstance. Now I know why my father left. He'd rather look bad than weak and stupid." Tevin had abandoned his son for only a few seconds, while his own father had abandoned him for an entire childhood. Even so, those few seconds were enough to change Tevin's writing and his life. Now, with a compassionate eye for the villainous father in the story, Tevin returned to his screenplay, which once again seemed to write itself, gushing from his fingertips so fast he could hardly keep up with the words streaming into his mind. Tevin's first attempt at the story had offered him a safe distance to pursue and slaughter his personal villain. This left him with little more than a child's angry crayon drawing rather than the commanding story that was trying to surface. After his epiphany, Tevin's story transformed into an entity of its own and became fully realized, belonging now to itself rather than the hurting inner child of its author. Early work typically fails to get finished, published, or produced because it tends to be blindly and notoriously autobiographical, with distorted villains and angelic heroes. Veteran writers look back upon their early work with humor and embarrassment, knowing that the more horrible a villain is, the more the writer has exposed a personal story. Realistic stories, however deeply fictional and fantastical they might be, are ultimately about the pain of shattered relationships. Of course, it is not necessary, wise, or advisable to attempt to repair a destroyed or dangerous relationship in order to write a story inspired by its pain. Writing a powerfully believable story only requires the writer to understand the truth of that relationship and what the story is asking of that truth. In other words, writers need to see both sides of the story with equanimity. The creative act asks writers to let go of logic, receive intuition, and deeply feel emotion. In the Western world, we are so out of touch with our own emotional being that we struggle to even identify which feelings are coursing through us. The American poet Robert Bly lamented that most Westerners are unable to distinguish or even find the words to discriminate between despair and depression, irritation and anger, or between sympathy and empathy. Human emotion is too complex and varied to comprehend through logic alone. Scientific study of emotion does nothing to teach us how to develop our emotional intelligence to live full emotional lives, let alone orchestrate them to develop powerful characters. It took Tevin a while to sort through his anger, grief, despair, and humiliation. Finally, he recognized through personal experience that it was shame he shared with his father. The melodramatic and brutally fierce villain in Tevin's early draft gave way to a realistic and worthy villain crushed beneath masked shame. This element sparked the story to life and propelled it forward. The dream images of story beckon us to untangle impossibly dense personal struggles. Because we are social creatures, those struggles will inevitably involve others. To succeed in working through our inner turmoil, we must be willing to see ourselves in all the good and bad characters of our story. Doing so will bring us the gift of doubt. Through doubt, we grow weary of the stale narrative we have been projecting onto the world and open our minds to something truly new. In The Practice of Zen, C.C. Chang writes, "The greater the doubt, the greater the awakening. The smaller the doubt, the smaller the awakening. No doubt, no awakening." Although I saw myself in Katrina, the protagonist of Baikal, it took years before I could see myself in the play's powerful sea captain or the Communist Party officer whom I had tagged as the villain. Like Katrina, these characters held secret messages for me from my own self. The captain was a metaphor for my growing power to navigate the world of literacy that I was beginning to command at the time I wrote the play. It was also a warning about how that power threatened to overwhelm me and cause me to lose my place in my clan. Likewise, the evil Communist Party officer reflected my family's propaganda, which followed me everywhere and infiltrated my every thought, with the mantra that my schooling was a waste of time and resources. In those moments when I succumbed to that way of thinking, I looked into a dark, horrifying future in which I foresaw that abandoning my education could cost me my life. We write stories to send messages to ourselves. Sometimes they take years to reach us. We also write to awaken ourselves by using fictional villains to dispel the anguish of real ones. Yet ultimately, a story is not a dream to be kept to oneself. The story uses our personal misery in the service of something greater. At some point, we must release our personal villains so that the villain in the story can serve the world by becoming fully human. So it is that Oedipus is no more a personal tirade of Sophocles than Hamlet is a pouting rant of Shakespeare. Whether they were aware of it or not, these great writers successfully addressed the personal call once they released the characters from their own ego-centered daydream to be born into the greater consciousness of society.